Hello and welcome to this week's podcast with me, Laura Merrilees. After what I think it's fair to say was a reasonably rough passage through Parliament, the Trade Union Act was finally enacted on the 4th of May this year. But what does the Act mean for employers? Is it as draconian as first suggested, and how will it change the landscape of industrial relations? There's a lot in there that affects trade unions, but we'll be looking today at the key points that affect employers. So with me now on the phone to discuss what the Act means for employers is Darren Newman, employment lawyer and consultant editor for Expert HR. Hi, Darren.
Hi, Laura. Thanks for having me.
Can you just give us an overview of what the bill originally set out to do and the impact that the Act is now likely to have on employers and unions alike?
Well, a lot of the bill was prefigured in the Conservative Party manifesto before they came into the last general election. And the key theme that they had was trying to increase what the government regards as the democratic legitimacy of industrial action. So a lot of it is focused on reforming the way in which industrial action ballots work, requiring minimum turnouts, minimum thresholds, that sort of thing, and also making sure that industrial action can't continue indefinitely once an industrial action ballot has taken place. There's been a number of high-profile public sector disputes that have been very long-lasting and have been ongoing for some years now, and the government wanted to make sure that didn't happen again in the future. And generally, there was a move in the bill to reform the way in which trade unions work and the way in which they're regulated. And it's something that the trade union movement itself was really very hostile to and regarded, frankly, as an attack.
But implementation itself, I understand that the bill isn't actually in force yet. When's that likely to happen?
That's right. It is an act. We should call it the Trade Union Act 2016. It's received royal assent. But it's one of those acts that's only brought into force by commencement order. So what we have to watch out for are individual commencement orders that will bring particular provisions into force over time. We don't have a formal timetable for that yet. It was generally expected, I think, that commencement would start to kick in pretty much from about now, a couple of months after royal assent was given. Obviously, we've had a slightly roller coaster time in terms of British politics, and we might well get a change in Secretary of State, and that could affect the timetable. So I frankly wouldn't want to take a guess at exactly when things are going to start coming into force.
Let's have a look at some of the key provisions in the Act, turning first to balloting requirements. What's changed here?
Well, I think this is probably the big headline measure in the Trade Union Act. On the starting point, the law as it currently is when you have an industrial action ballot, you need to make sure that you give an opportunity to vote to all of the members who might be called on to take part in industrial action. But there's no minimum turnout requirement. So in order to authorise industrial action, all you need is a majority of those who actually vote saying yes to the industrial action. And that was a key thing that the bill was designed to change. So there are basically two thresholds that are being introduced. The first, which will apply to all industrial action, is that there must be at least a 50% turnout. So if you have 100 people who are entitled to vote, and all of my examples will involve 100 people, then for a valid ballot to take place, at least 50 of them must actually vote. You must have a 50% turnout. But for most industrial action ballots, as long as you've got that 50% turnout, you only need a bare majority of those voting to support the action. So if you had 50 people voting in the ballot, you'd only need to have 26 people voting in favour of industrial action to make it lawful. There's a second threshold, however, when we look at important public services, and we'll talk in a bit more detail about exactly what they are. Not only must there be a 50% threshold in terms of turnout, but you must also have at least 40% of those entitled to vote saying yes to the industrial action. So that means in our example of 100 people, if you had 50 people voting in the ballot to meet the minimum threshold, 40 of them, rather than 26, would have to say yes to support industrial action in these important public services. So essentially, the smaller the turnout you had, the larger the majority you need in an industrial action ballot in order to lawfully take industrial action.
So key for employers is to know, you know, how important public services will be defined. What do we know about this so far, and can we expect to know more about it? Will guidance be coming out?
Well, it's actually something that can only be defined by regulations. It's a slightly odd provision in the Act, because it says, on the one hand, and this is Section 3, that important public services has whatever meaning is given to that phrase by regulations made by the Secretary of State. But those regulations can only specify services that fall within certain categories. And we have health services, education of those aged under 17, so it'll cover teachers but not lecturers, the provision of fire services, transport services, the decommissioning of nuclear installations and management of radioactive waste and spent fuel, and border security. So those are what are regarded as the important public services. And what we need is regulations telling us how we know whether people are engaged in that activity or not and exactly what the scope is. Transport services, for instance, we can expect that to apply to workers on the tube, but it's not, I would suspect, going to apply to a logistics firm that has some van drivers delivering goods or people driving minibuses as part of a coach company. It's infrastructure issues, I suspect, rather than anything you could describe as transport. And that's the sort of thing that will have to be defined in the regulations.
It seems like there is the potential for unions to get it wrong, though, particularly where you have a mixed workforce, so not all the employees are involved in providing important public services. Is there anything that can be done if that's the case?
Well, there is a certain amount of wriggle room for trade unions, and this was something that was softened over the course of the passage of the bill. So there are a number of things we could look at. First of all, the threshold will only apply where it's the majority of those entitled to vote in the ballot are engaged in the services. So if you've got a mixed ballot where some people are engaged in key services and some people aren't, the question is there a majority? The second point is that it's only going to be workers directly involved in the delivery of those services that will count for this. If you're doing ancillary or back office work, if you're an administrator, say, then you don't count as one of the employees where the special threshold applies. And finally, there is a sort of get-out clause that if the union reasonably believes that the majority are not engaged in key public services, then the threshold doesn't apply. So if there's a reasonable argument either way as to whether these people qualify under the 40% threshold or not, then to an extent the union gets the benefit of the doubt.
Turning now to the issue of how a union ballots its members. At the moment, this is all still done via the post, which seems pretty outdated. And I know that there was talk of introducing electronic balloting. Where are we with this?
Well, this was one of the highly contentious issues when the bill was going through Parliament. It's absolutely true, and the reason that the balloting thresholds are regarded as problematic is that, on average, large-scale industrial action ballots tend to have a very low turnout, sometimes in the 20s or 30s%. And one of the reasons for that, I don't think there's any doubt about this, is that a ballot at the moment has to be fully postal. That means that the balloting papers have to be posted to union members, and union members have to fill them in and then post those back to the independent body that's carrying out the ballot. That makes the ballot time-consuming, it makes it expensive, but it also tends to mitigate against a large-scale turnout because, frankly, the balloting paper arrives with a load of offers for a Barclay card and pizza menus, and lots of people don't notice they've got it, and lots of people don't get around to posting it back. So if we had electronic balloting so that you could actually simply log online and register your vote, then union strike ballots would be cheaper, they would be much quicker, and turnout would likely be much higher. The government was concerned that electronic ballots aren't secure enough, that it's too easy to interfere with the way in which the ballot is conducted. So they were unwilling to allow an amendment simply to let electronic voting happen. But there was a lot of shilly-shallying in Parliament. What we eventually came up with was a promise of an independent review. So Section 4 of the Act requires the Secretary of State to commission an independent review into methods of electronic balloting, which then has to be laid before each House of Parliament. There's no obligation to follow the recommendations of that review, but the Secretary of State has to consider the report and publish a formal response to it. Now, the idea is that that review must be commissioned within 6 months of the Act receiving royal assent. So that should mean that we get the review commissioned at least by November of this year. Now, it shouldn't be the Chilcot inquiry, it shouldn't take 7 years to report, but there'll certainly be a time delay there. And, you know, if I'm going to be cynical, we should bear in mind that this Section 4 isn't in force yet, and if the government wanted to completely dodge the obligation to carry out a review, all it needs to do is not bring Section 4 into force. It's already done a similar thing with gender pay gap regulations, where the gender pay gap regulations were supposed to be laid by March this year, but the provision that required that was never brought into force.
So given the changes to the balloting requirements, what potential impact do you see these changes having on the industrial relations landscape generally, particularly for employers?
I think that could be very interesting, because your sort of initial reaction to this might be, well, this is going to render lots of industrial action ballots unlawful because they tend to get a low turnout. But we should remember a couple of things. First of all, hitherto, unions haven't had to get a large turnout. If a union has to actually campaign to get a large turnout, then maybe it will be more successful. It's not something it's ever had to push for before. And if they do get a large turnout, that gives them better bargaining power when it comes to talking to the employer, because they can look at a very successful union ballot showing that the members support the union's position. And we should bear in mind that in previous legal developments, when ballots were first introduced, for example, they were initially treated in a very negative way by trade unions, but they eventually managed to find a way to use them to their advantage as part of the negotiation process. And I would imagine that that would happen again. We may also see more careful targeting of industrial action ballots, because the ballots that get low turnout at the moment tend to be large nationwide ballots affecting lots of groups of employers. So the whole of the teaching profession, for example, or workers in local government. Where a union conducts a small ballot focused on a particular workplace or a particular type of employee within the workplace, then it tends to be much more successful in getting large-scale turnout. So I would suspect that what we would see are fewer nationwide ballots, but more targeted ballots. So unions, if they've got any sense, in my view, will become much more discriminating and targeted in the way in which they take industrial action.
Turning to the minimum notice period that a union has to give to an employer before being able to start industrial action, what's changed there?
Well, it's a relatively straightforward change. The current position until this law comes into force is that unions have to give 7 days notice of industrial action. That's going to go up to 14. It will be possible for the employer and the union to agree that 7 days notice will stay the appropriate thing, but I don't see why an employer would agree to that. So I think we can say that the default position is going to be you must give 14 days notice of a ballot. And actually, there's an important point here about timing, which I didn't make clear when we were talking about balloting thresholds, that when it comes to balloting thresholds, the new rules, whenever they come into force, will only apply to ballots that start after the law comes into force. So existing ballots will remain valid. When it comes to this threshold of notification, however, going from 7 days to 14 days, that will apply to each notification of industrial action, even where the ballot was conducted some time ago and industrial action has been ongoing. So if we take the current teachers dispute, for example, where we're still getting regular instances of industrial action based on a very well-established, long-established ballot, at the moment, the teaching unions only need to give 7 days notice of industrial action in a particular school. But when this law comes in, the next notice they will have to give will be 14 days notice, even dealing with the existing dispute.
Okay, so there's a technical point there under the Act that's actually got a fairly significant practical impact.
Absolutely.
Okay, I understand that there have also been changes to the information that needs to be included in the voting paper, although that information isn't as detailed as we first anticipated under the original bill.
Yes, the initial bill was really quite draconian on this, and it required the union to specify in some detail what the dispute was about. At the moment, there are all sorts of rules about what a voting paper has to say, but it doesn't have to say anything about the nature of the dispute. It just has to say, do you support taking industrial action, yes or no? And then there's various other requirements about what needs to go on that voting paper. When this provision comes into force, this is Section 5, then the voting paper will have to include a summary of the matter or matters in issue in the trade dispute. So it will have to give some indication of what the trade dispute is about. The problem with this is that we still don't know what a summary is. We don't quite know what a summary means. Is it okay, for example, for the union to say on the voting paper, do you support taking industrial action in pursuit of our pay dispute? Is that enough of a summary of what is in issue? Or does it have to say, do you support taking industrial action in support of our pay dispute where the employer is only offering 1%? Or in support of our pay dispute rejecting the employer's offer of 1%? And the issue that's going to be crucial there is, if you have to describe the trade dispute in that much detail, what happens if the employer's offer changes? What happens, as usually happens with large-scale pay disputes and ongoing disputes of this sort, there is a shifting in bargaining positions from either side. At what point will that tip over into a position where the union's summary of the issue in dispute is no longer accurate? Because once we get to that point, there's an argument that the ballot will cease to be valid, and employers will be able to get an injunction or require a new ballot to be held. So I think this is potentially a very important issue.
Yeah, and it's, as you mentioned, there's obviously the potential still for mistakes to occur, but perhaps slightly less of a risk of that happening than as originally drafted.
Yeah, the bar is not being set as high as it was originally when the bill was there, but there is still a bar, and the courts are going to have to decide how high it is.
Yeah. Now, we were talking at the beginning about the government's intentions under the bill when it was originally drafted, and one of the intentions there was to introduce a finite period for strikes. Tell us, has that actually happened under the Act?
It has, but it's been softened as the bill progressed through Parliament. This was something that was in the Conservative Party manifesto, and I think they were thinking of specific disputes, actually. There's an NUT ballot, which I think took place in 2011, which is still, as we speak, resulting in industrial action. The Fire Brigades Union has had long-standing industrial action again for a ballot that has gone back some years. And the government wanted to make sure that one industrial action ballot could not be used to justify industrial action on an open-ended basis. The first draft of the bill had a very draconian provision that said that after 4 months, the ballot would cease to be effective. And the problem with that was that it gave the unions and the employers very little scope to agree a postponement of industrial action while talks took place. And so what happened was the government extended that provision so that now the position is that once a ballot has started, the union has 6 months to take its industrial action, and at the end of 6 months, it will have to re-ballot if it wants to take any further action. But the employer and the union can agree that that period is extended to 9 months. So if, in the run-up to the initial deadline, the employer makes a new proposal and invites the union to postpone its industrial action while talks take place, there's actually room for that to happen without the union being trapped into having to re-ballot. So I think that's a positive development as it's gone through Parliament.
Absolutely. So moving on to requirements around picketing, can you just take us through what's changed here?
Well, actually, relatively little has changed in practical terms. This was something that, in the publicity surrounding the bill, was a very big issue for trade unions, but that was largely because of a consultation the government was carrying out about ways in which picketing could be further regulated, which suggested things like having to inform the police about any social media campaign and that sort of thing. What actually happened, if we look at what came through in the bill and is now in the Act, is that some provisions of the current ACAS code of practice on picketing are simply written into the law as a requirement for a picket. And in practical terms, I don't think that's going to make an awful lot of difference. The key requirement is that the union who's organising the picket must appoint a person to supervise that picket, who must be an official of the union, and the police need to be informed of who the picket supervisor is and where the picketing will take place and be given the picket supervisor's phone number. So, you know, those aren't very draconian provisions because they're already in a code of practice. The union has to give the picket supervisor a letter saying that the picketing has been approved, and if the employer asks to have a look at that letter, they're allowed to have a look at it. So as these things have come out in the wash, I don't think anything has happened that's going to transform the nature of picketing. We've maybe just ratcheted up the legal requirements slightly, but in practical terms, I don't think it's a big deal.
So just looking at the steps employers can take to mitigate the effects of industrial action, as I understand it, employers are not currently permitted to hire agency staff during strikes. Has anything changed on that front?
We expect something to change, but nothing has changed as yet. This is something that's not in the Trade Union Act itself. It's actually in Regulation 7, I think, of the regulations regulating agency work. And what that says is it's actually a criminal offence to supply an agency worker to replace someone who's on strike. That's the direct replacement of a striking worker by an agency worker is unlawful. You can hire agency workers to pick up the backlog of work left by someone who's been on strike, but you can't replace someone who's actually on strike. And the government has consulted over whether to remove this provision, and the consultation ended back in September, but we haven't as yet seen any development from that. When I say consulted, I think we have to put consulted slightly in inverted commas, because if we look at the Conservative Party manifesto, they said that they would repeal this nonsensical provision. So I don't think they're entirely open-minded about whether that provision should stay or go. Having said that, I simply don't know why it's taken them so long to get round to this, because they haven't followed through on the consultation and actually changed the rules yet, but it's certainly something to watch.
Okay, so just moving on to the final area of change under the Trade Union Act that we're going to discuss today, which again affects the public sector. I understand that there are a couple of provisions in the Act in addition to the 40% threshold that will impact public sector employers, and the first is around the check-off process. Can you just take us through that, please?
Okay, well starting with exactly what check-off is, nothing to do with a Russian playwright. What we're looking at here is a system where an employer deducts union membership subscriptions from an employee's pay and then gives that directly to the union. And it's something that dates back to the time when unions were collecting from employees who were paid in cash, and it would have been very difficult to go round and time-consuming to collect money from each individual. And so agreements were made with employers that recognised trade unions that the employer would do that collection for them. That's actually a system that works very well for employers who operate it. I don't know of any employers who are doing that against their will. And it's slightly ironic that the government was coming along trying to stop this from happening and was so keen to inconvenience trade unions that it didn't mind inconveniencing some public sector employers along the way. I didn't come across any employer that I talked to when this bill was going through Parliament who was actually unhappy with the check-off arrangements that they had. As the debate went through, though, the government softened its position, and rather than ban check-off in the public sector entirely, which was the first plan, the Act now says that an employer can conduct a check-off arrangement provided that it's charging the union for that service. And this is something that's quite common in the public sector, that a public sector employer will be conducting a check-off arrangement but will actually charge an admin fee to the union. I've come across employers who are actually making a profit on the deal. So they were very annoyed at the prospect of being prevented from doing it altogether. So the government says you can still carry on with the check-off arrangement, providing the union is paying its way. Essentially, the government doesn't want the public sector to be subsidising the administration of a trade union.
And just the final point in relation to the public sector is the amount of facility time that's spent by union officials. There's been some change here, or at least there may be change on the horizon. I don't believe it's all yet in force.
Yeah, change on the horizon. Again, this comes to the idea of the government being concerned that public sector employers are subsidising the trade union movement. And one of the ways it thinks that's happening is by public sector employers giving paid time off to trade union members, particularly trade union officials. Now, there are various provisions in the law that give trade union officials a right to time off, some paid, some unpaid. So if they're going to be conducting collective bargaining, they're given a right to time off in connection with that. They've got a right to time off where they're representing the trade union. They've got a right to time off as learning representatives. They've got a right to time off when it comes to representing people in disciplinary and grievance hearings. That stays in place, but the government is concerned that employers in the public sector were being overgenerous and that there were too many employees who essentially, whether formally or informally, were working full-time on union business rather than doing the job that they were employed to do. Now, the government hasn't banned it, but what they are proposing to do is issue regulations that will require public sector bodies to report, really in quite a lot of detail, about what paid time off they're giving union officials. So they will have to start expressing that time off in absolute terms, but also as a proportion of their payroll and the amount of time that's actually being spent on union duties at public expense. Once those regulations come in and have been given an opportunity to bed down, I think the period in the Act is 3 years, the government then has some reserve powers to bring in yet more regulations that could potentially limit a particular employer's ability to grant paid time off to trade union officials. So the government is basically saying that they think if public sector bodies have to report the amount of facility time that they grant, then the amount of facility time will fall off dramatically. But if it doesn't fall off dramatically, the government reserves the right to intervene with a particular employer and require it to grant less facility time. Now, I have to say again, this is something that when I've talked to public sector employers, they're not happy at the prospect of this interference. Many of them value the work that trade union officials are doing, and very often the amount of time off that's being granted is very much at the request of the employer, because the employer wants to introduce a change program, for example, and needs to talk to union officials about it, or there's a large-scale exercise going on and unions need to represent people in hearings as a result of that. So I think quite a lot of public sector employers will be slightly worried about this, but any changes is probably quite distant on the horizon. We'll have to wait and see when the government gets around to introducing regulations.
Okay, well, that's interesting, and, you know, we'll keep the site updated, but as you say, it may be a little way down the line. Well, thanks very much, Darren, for taking us through the changing landscape of industrial relations. As mentioned, we'll monitor the Act as it comes into force, so do look out for further information on the site. A good first port of call is the Trade Union and Industrial Relations chapter of the Employment Law Manual, which you can find under the Tools section. So that brings us to the end of this week's Expert HR podcast, which you've been listening to with me, Laura Merrilies. We'll be back next Friday, but until then, it's goodbye from us.